May it please the court. Counsel Douglas Shepherd for Ms. Erickson. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes. There's a lot in this appeal, including improper expert disclosure, improper expert declarations, and improper expert foundation at trial. I want to talk about the disclosure process and what happened at trial, unless the panel has some questions on the disclosure. The fact is we sent out interrogatories, which existed for about 2 years, as to what their experts were and what they were going to testify to, and they did not answer them. The fact is we moved for summary judgment 2 months before trial, and after our motion and their response and our reply, we got the first opinion from an expert, which is Dr. Kirby, which is 4 days before the summary judgment.
But the Supreme Court has been real clear in Keck versus Collins that even in dealing with summary judgment motions, you have to apply the Burnett factors and decide what the actual prejudice is. And the court did that here.
Well, actually, the court did the day of the hearing, because we were not aware of the Keck case until the day of the hearing when it was handed to us. The court made findings on excusable neglect, reasonable justification, no substantial prejudice, was not a willful or intentional, and there were appropriate lesser sanctions. The problem is that was made without a declaration from Peace Health's counsel as to why they were late in filing the declarations. There was no evidence to determine what the excuse was or what the reason was. There was argument, but there was no declaration. In the CAC, there were all kinds of declarations explaining the delay and how they had tried to get opinions.
Is your position then that the court would always need a declaration?
Well, actually, my position is, and I didn't have the case at that time, since we've briefed this case, Puget Sound Security Patrol versus Bates at 197 Washington App 461 by Division One, says when the responsive declarations are filed after the motion and the response and the reply, which raises the issue, the trial court did not need to conduct the Burnett analysis, because Puget Sound did not submit the challenge declarations in opposition to the summary judgment. They submitted in opposition to what the reply said. Under those circumstances,
well, isn't that different than what we have here?
It's almost all four. We raised in our reply that there was no declaration supporting their argument in their response.
Let's assume that you're right, that maybe the trial court erred. What relief can we possibly give you? There was a trial.
Well, let's talk about it.
What exactly are you asking?
I'm asking for it to go back on damages, because let's talk about what happened.
So you're asking us to issue a ruling saying that the court should have issued an order saying that the defendant was liable as a matter of
granting summary judgment. And if not, as we move through the trial, the declaration was merely conclusory. The declaration said simply, Dr. Holstein's preoperative care, surgery, and postoperative care met the standard of care. So after it got filed, I raised that issue. I was allowed to go take his deposition. I honestly did not think it was a mistake. I've been doing this for almost four decades. I would never respond to summary judgment with a conclusory declaration like that. I never have. I assumed they would not be able to get a doctor to say that an orthopedic surgeon in the state of Washington does not have to, for 7 months, diagnose a broken bone or treat it. So I didn't think they were going to see something that would say that. I suspected when I saw it that they've been trying to get a more detailed declaration, had not been able to get one. And so I took his deposition, and then I prepared for trial. And I hope the court is aware that at trial, Dr. Kirby said he would have taken an X-ray, that he knows Dr. Holstein never took an X-ray, that physicians in the exercise of due care need to take the time to accurately pinpoint the source of patient's complaint, that a differential diagnosis was required, that a differential diagnosis required them to rule out a broken bone, that if he was ruling out a broken bone, he would have taken an X-ray, that while rare, a fractured acromion after the procedure that Dr. Holstein did is a recognized complication of the procedure, that Mrs. Erickson's history in May at Dr. Holstein's office was she had pain in her right shoulder at a level of 9 to 10. There was a pop that she thought was a gunshot, and she believed she had broken her shoulder after the procedure. Dr. Kirby understood in his testimony that Dr. Holstein, with that history, did not take an X-ray, took no images. 2 months later, took an MRI, which is for soft tissue. He would have done a CT scan or an X-ray, and he did nothing for 7 months. That Dr. Kirby does not rely upon an MRI done by a radiologist, because I've seen so many times I disagree with the radiologist, so I always read my own images. All of this testimony is consistent with the 11-page report we gave to the hospital 2 years before trial, consistent with the 5-page declaration we put in moving for summary judgment, and consistent with the testimony of our expert. There is no grounds to allow this to go to the jury after they heard the testimony. So why would we send it back for another trial so that they can get another expert? I don't like the term junk science, but there's no science involved in the testimony of Dr. Kirby that an orthopedic surgeon does not need to diagnose or treat a broken bone for a patient that repeatedly comes into their office complaining that they believe the bone is broken and their pain levels are 9, 7, and 8 over months. So what this panel should do is send it back for a trial on damages, or else the rules of procedure, the rules of evidence, and all the case law talking about conclusory opinions have no meaning. And there's chaos in the courtroom. This case, if it's allowed to stand, will create nothing but chaos. Does the panel have any questions for me?
No.
Makes me nervous when there's no questions. I got time to respond.
Yes, you do.
Thank you.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Heath Fox here representing the respondents, Peace Health and Dr. Holstein. This is a straightforward Med-Mal case involving a very common shoulder surgery and a rare but well-recognized complication from that procedure. At trial, both sides were able to put on orthopedic expert testimony. The jury heard both experts rigorously cross-examined on their differing opinions. But at the end of the day, there was ample evidence from which the jury could conclude that Dr. Holstein complied with the applicable standard of care.
Well, what we've just heard is that the expert that you relied on simply had conclusory opinions with no support.
Well, I would disagree with that contention, Your Honor, both in his declaration and at trial. At trial, he testified at length. RP 508, he testified that I think this is absolutely the standard of care, what Dr. Holstein did, and the images prove that it was good work. Lengthy testimony from RP 502 to 532 about reasons why the modality for diagnosis post-op to try and manage that patient's pain was the most appropriate one available. An MRI study was most likely to show the most applicable information for the most likely causes of that patient's pain.
Do you agree that Dr. Kirby testified that there should have been an X-ray done?
I don't think that's an accurate statement of the record. I think he did testify that in a lot of cases, if you're trying to rule out a broken bone, an X-ray is an appropriate study. He did say in this case he would have ordered an X-ray, and actually he testified to the contrary, that in this case, at RP 1194, he testified that X-ray is a pretty low yield, unreliable for diagnosis of an acromial fracture, which is what this patient ultimately had. He was very low down on Dr. Holstein's differential because, having done hundreds, maybe 1,000 of these procedures before, he'd never seen that. And did not think it was very likely, given the mechanism of injury described by the plaintiff, which was reaching out for a pair of scissors at home, not a fall or a car crash or the kind of situation where he would be considering higher up on the differential the possibility of a fractured acromion. Regarding the way in which Dr. Kirby's declaration was accidentally omitted from the moving papers on summary judgment, there was a discussion about whether there needed to be a separate declaration from counsel putting more evidence into the record as to why things happened the way they did. But in this case, It was never contested. It was the defendant's error. Defendants freely admitted it was their mistake. It was supposed to be submitted with the moving papers. It was cited verbatim in terms of the substantive portions of that declaration in the body of the brief. So the plaintiff had all of those opinions available at the time that they were preparing their reply brief. But rather than pick up the phone to tell counsel, hey, we got your brief, but it talks about a declaration, but we didn't get the declaration. Instead, plaintiff waited till the reply due date to raise the issue. At that point, the declaration was promptly sent over, and then plaintiffs responded with a motion to strike too close to the hearing date to get a formal response in. So counsel at that.
Do you think Keck versus Collins requires some sort of affidavit or substantiation? As I read this record here, it's just simply counsel saying we messed up, and it just inadvertently wasn't sent. But is there a higher standard required for excusable neglect here?
Well, I think Keck requires the trial court to go through the Burnett factors and whatever that may be. I think that's more case-specific analysis in terms of what is excusable neglect in a case-by-case basis. But in this case, let's assume for the sake of argument that the defendants had the most sinister of all motives, that this was a willful, calculated act, and they admitted as much to the trial court. The trial court would still have to go through the other two Burnett factors to consider prejudice to the plaintiff. In this case, the court did not see how there could be any prejudice since they were apprised of the opinions in a timely way in the body of the brief and had been previously offered the opportunity to depose Dr. Kirby. But even if...
Where is that in the record that offer was made? I couldn't find it.
The offer
to... It said in the brief, we offered up the name of this person months before, but I didn't see anywhere in the record where there was some...
I apologize, Your Honor. I don't have a clerk's paper citation to that offer. I do believe in plaintiff's brief, it's acknowledged that he was disclosed at the deadline for expert witness disclosures, and there was plenty of time in the normal discovery period in which his deposition could have been requested, and that was never done. But then even in the Burnett factor analysis, if the trial court felt that this was a willful violation, not an accident, but if it was willful, let's say even malicious for tactical advantage, and there was some potential prejudice, the court would still have to consider what is the least restrictive sanction that will accomplish the goals of the court to further justice in the case. And there would still be a large range of options. You know, the court could obligate Dr. Kirby to be made available on short notice. In this case, the court required the defendants to pay for not only Dr. Kirby's time for the deposition, but also plaintiff counsel's time for the deposition. So,
appellant also argues that even if we get to trial, that his testimony at trial was actually supported the plaintiff's position more than the defense position, and therefore there should have been a judgment as a matter of law. What's your response to that?
I would disagree. I would ask to see where in the record that is substantiated. Clearly, the jury disagreed. The jury was able to listen to the whole trial, all of Dr. Kirby's testimony. And I would point to RP 501, 508, 502 through 508, 519 through 532, 845 and 848 for examples of where Dr. Kirby was very strongly in support of Dr. Holstein's testimony and described in detail how the imaging showed that it was good work. It effectively proved, after the fact, with the benefit of hindsight, that the surgical procedure was performed properly according to the standard of care, and also that the postoperative management of the patient's pain was appropriate. It's very common to have pain after this procedure. 90 to 100% of patients will report pain, and it's expected to last for a while. When the patient's pain did not improve at around 6 weeks postoperatively, where Dr. Holstein would have expected to see some improvement in the patient's reported pain, that's when he authorized an MRI, which, according to both Dr. Holstein and Dr. Kirby, is the gold standard test. It's the one that's most likely to give the best information about the more common causes of postoperative pain. I'm assuming that the the plaintiff's listed issue regarding jury instruction number 13, the exercise of judgment instruction, is no longer properly before the court because it wasn't briefed. But if the court would like any comment on that, I think the Fergin case is controlling. Our Supreme Court has recently reaffirmed the continuing validity of that instruction. And in this case, not every medical malpractice warrants the instruction, but this is the kind of case where it really is required because Dr. Holstein was being criticized for facing a choice of diagnostic modalities to come to a diagnosis for this patient, and he had to exercise his best judgment to choose which study to order and then how to interpret those results to come to a working diagnosis for this patient. And the trial court spent a lot of time reviewing all the case law related to that instruction and felt it was appropriate to give based on the testimony that had been put before the jury in the case. Regarding standard of review, the plaintiff's motion for judgment as a matter of law and motion for new trial are the substantial evidence standard. I think the Singh v. John L. Scott case outlines that, although I'm sure this court knows that standard better than I ever will. But it's not a standard by which the court is asked to step into the shoes of the jury and reweigh all of the evidence to decide if it agrees with the outcome, but merely to look at the evidence and see, is there sufficient quantum of evidence from which a reasonable jury could reach the outcome that they did? And defendants would ask that the verdict be affirmed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The argument asks this panel to assume that Peace Health's skilled counsel does not know what they're doing. They talked about apprised of opinions. I sent out interrogatories 2 years before the trial, which were not answered. There were discovery cutoff dates and orders from the court, which were not complied with. Yes, I got Dr. Kirby's opinion, one-sentence opinion, 3 weeks before trial, and after the motion for summary judgment, after their response, and after our reply.
Do you disagree with the representation that the brief that they filed contained the opinions of Dr. Kirby?
I thought that might be raised. Here's what it contained, and it's paragraph 7 of Dr. Kirby's declaration. They put in their response that he would testify that pain and popping sensations in the early postoperative period are common for this procedure and do not by themselves call for additional imaging early postoperative period. The problem was we had the declaration of Mrs. Erickson that said there was a loud pop like a gunshot. I had pain in 9 to 10, and I believed I'd broken the arm, and I told Dr. Holstein that. During trial, I'd be happy to leave the panel with the verbatim record of the cross-examination of Dr. Kirby. Dr. Kirby admitted that Dr. Holstein didn't just have that. He had from her in her medical history that she had a loud pop, believed the gunshot had gone out, had pain of 9 to 10, and thought she had broken her shoulder. So this part of Dr. Kirby's doesn't do anything for Peace Health.
But Dr. Kirby still testified that Dr. Holstein complied with the standard of care.
It's a mere opinion until it's examined by all the testimony.
Well, you cross-examined extensively, and the jury apparently rejected it.
Well, the gatekeeper is the court, and this court. The jury verdicts on plaintiff's malpractice in the state of Washington since the Tort Reform Act is 2% in favor of plaintiffs because junk science gets to be testified to. If we have the burden of proof and one doctor says that it's black, even though it's not supported by science, and we say it's white, we're probably going to lose because we have the burden of proof. They have to come in and give medicine and science. They can't come in and just make it up. And that's what happened in this case. I agree the jury was left to walk in the quicksand because there was no gatekeeping function done pre-trial, during the summary judgment, or during trial. At some point, experts have to have a foundation. They didn't have it. They didn't give it to me. He didn't have it when the trial was over. What's the prejudice to us? We've had to go all this way, hundreds of thousands of dollars, to demonstrate that to this panel. That it's nothing. Priest House has nothing. They stand marching as a king did with no clothes. And it's the jury's decision to make the determination. No, it's this court's decision. It starts at 558 in verbatim record. Thank you.
Thank you.